Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with co-host Alan Phillips, attorney at law from North Carolina, leading vaccine rights attorney. Today is November 8th, 2012. Here, thank you so much for listening to these free informative broadcasts, for clicking up, sending us comments, calling in with questions, and to share on Twitter, Facebook, and your own websites, and putting them on social networks like Facebook, Dig, StumbleUpon, and Reddit. We really appreciate that you favorite the show and get the reminder button. So, we are about to begin another hour and discussing the current events, the flavor of the day, what's happening. And we have a lot to talk about regarding links of vaccines to autism, what's up with that influenza shot, and what the government is now telling us. And I think, Alan, you have a couple of other items, too. So where do you want to begin?
Well, let's go ahead and start with that article you were talking about that was addressing the question of vaccines and autism, because we have, let me give just a little bit of background. This will be repeat information perhaps for folks who have listened to the show regularly in the past, but just by way of sort of introduction. The CDC, of course, has always taken the position that vaccines don't cause autism. In fact, their website has language to the effect of there's absolutely nothing to suggest any connection whatsoever between vaccines and autism, but we now know that that is a deliberately...
We just lost you.
My phone. Okay. Am I still there?
You're still with us. You must.
I had a phone fall off the hook. Sorry to say.
Right.
We now know the CDC's position is deliberately and blatantly fraudulent, because. Last year, the Coalition for Mercury Free Drugs, or COMED, a nonprofit organization, as I'm speaking here, having problems with my internet and website pages here. We had information that COMED got through the Freedom of Information Act from the federal government that had CDC emails earlier in the last decade. CDC officials and study authors were emailing back and forth, and they had data that showed when they took the mercury out of vaccines that the autism rates went down in a study group of children in Denmark, and they were debating whether or not to include that data in a published study, and the resulting, what was at least informally referred to as the Denmark study, the resulting study is a study that has been used to quote-unquote prove that vaccines don't cause autism, and in fact, data in the study showed that vaccines do cause autism, and they deliberately chose to leave that data out to give the exact opposite impression with the published study. I mean, I think people should go to prison for that. But in any event, the CDC's position has clearly been revealed to be fraudulent, and in fact, there are a number of studies that show some direct relationship between vaccines and autism. Just last year, three different studies. One was a review by former senior pharmaceutical researcher Helen Ratajczak, who did a review of the medical literature on vaccines and autism, and concluded, after reviewing studies from the 1940s to the present, that vaccines are a cause of autism. It didn't say the cause, but said a cause of autism, that the encephalitis, autism following encephalitis that follows vaccination in infants can lead to autism, can cause autism. We had another study that found that there was a very likely a correlation between the aluminum and vaccines and autism. And another study that showed that for every 1% increase in vaccine coverage in the U.S., that there is another 680 autism cases. So we have plenty of evidence out there. But this thing, this information you're talking about, Debbie, is something different, I think, from all of these things. And tell us, if you would please, what this article and information talks about.
I think I'm looking at the one that's the CDC Autism and Vaccine Research Indicted for Fraud, which is... That is the one that... that was the one that you just described. And so there's another one that is on Nature, the monkey vaccine. Nope. I'm sorry. We're going to have to come back to that one. I know that I had the information, but vaccines cause autism symptoms in infant primates. And that's the one that we wanted to look at. The link between autism and vaccinations is, again, coming up surfacing because of this type of a study. That infant macaw, how do you pronounce those primates? They're macaw, maybe, primates, after being injected with vaccinations that follow the 1990 CDC recommended schedule. So they're doing the standard schedule that they would have for injecting in children, and this is reported in Natural News and all over the different websites. If vaccines play absolutely no role in the development of childhood autism, a claim made by many medical authorities today, which is what you just said, then why are some of the most popular vaccines commonly administered to children demonstrably causing autism in animal primates? And I think that the link is that monkeys are so close to humans, and they would obviously respond in the same way that humans would. And so the question is, how did they come about with the conclusions that they did, that the monkeys were presenting with autistic type of behavior? And that's something that we probably need to investigate a little bit more. There was this investigator, Laura Hewitson, PhD, when they were studying these primates between 1994 and 1999, giving things like the measles, mumps, and rubella, the MMR vaccine, and also the thimerosal mercury-containing vaccines. They found that the autism spectrum disorder really skyrocketed. And this was published in a research paper in Acta Neurobiologica Experimentales in 2010, meaning it's like 3 years old. And why we're just coming up with it, I'm not sure. But she titled it Influence of Pediatric Vaccines on Amygdala Growth and Opioid Ligand Binding in Rhesus Macaw Infants, a pilot study. So I guess maybe this just, if it's always been out there, this information for 3 years, maybe it's just coming into the global view that we're finding it. I don't know. That was pretty scientific. Did you catch all that?
I can't say I caught all of it, but I think. There's a lot of points raised there. First of all, there are tens of thousands, if not more, medical studies published every year that anybody could ever be expected to keep up with any parts of it, certainly, of course, not all of it, but any parts of it in particular. That's a question unto itself. I think what's more, given the volume, the vast volume of medical research that's published all the time, it's a wonder that anybody keeps up with any of it. So theoretically, of course, doctors are keeping up with areas with certainly should be trying to keep up with studies published in their particular areas of expertise or focus. And many doctors, it's all they can do to occasionally keep up with, you know, summaries of studies or conclusions in their area generally. So it doesn't surprise me at all, especially when there's disincentive to see or acknowledge anything that would in any way be anti-vaccine, that pediatricians or others in the vaccine arena either just don't see all that's going on, or perhaps even worse, will just sort of automatically dismiss any study that's not favorable to vaccines as obviously being one of those bad studies. It's just so easy for people to, for any number of reasons or combination of reasons, to screen out the things that are not supporting their preconceived notion or whatever is going to support them personally and their career professionally and so forth. So it's you know, there's many different facets to the issue. But it's particularly disturbing, though, when there's research that directly contradicts a government agency's position on a topic, especially when there is research in the form of multiple peer-reviewed published studies. And unless you're just going to categorically assume up front that any study that doesn't agree with your preconceived position is automatically bad, and of course that's not something that would at all be legitimate, but that's the only way I can see that the CDC or any other government agency or non-government entity for that matter can cling to this position that vaccines don't cause autism. The problem for us as a society, though, is that these agencies have clout and either clout with and or control over at least the mainstream media, and so their views become the dominant views in our society. And equally disturbing, if not even more disturbing, is that the legal system seems to adopt the health authorities' views in terms of what policies get enacted into law and what decisions come from the courts when there are disputes or conflicts. And I find myself telling people, by the way, a lot talking about litigation with vaccine rights issues, that courts do not, as a general rule, decide the science. And occasionally a judge will say, yeah, let me hear both sides of the story. They'll actually let a alternative medical doctor come in and give the opposing view. But if the court's position is to weigh the evidence, and that's what courts do generally, as opposed to decide the science, it doesn't matter how convincing and crystal clear and articulate the alternative medical doctor is, if the mainstream doctor is backed by the CDC and the state health agencies and the majority of doctors, that's going to carry the weight of the evidence. So
I think that people, and I truly understand it, you know, you want to have some kind of balance. You want to hear two sides of the story. You want to be give equal say to all parties. And if this information is coming from a news source such as Natural News, which you might say is an extreme news media on alternative or out of the box, not the conservative point of view, then you might begin to question, where did the information come from? What does it really say? I need to go and read the article myself or the publication. And I think people should do that. And when people do, they might find out that it either confirms what they believe or they have more questions to ask themselves. And I think that that is valid. That is what people should do. And in this particular article, there was somebody who felt that it was not enough information in the study, you know, that there weren't enough primates being given the injections and comparatively one side getting a placebo and another side getting the actual vaccines. I can understand that. The question that I might have is, if the outcome is such that it's questionable, it should be restudied again, and that it still puts a little bit a hole in the 100% this is a good thing, although we already have that right now. We already know that vaccines are not 100% safe and they do carry risk. So it's just another piece of evidence to put on that side of the basket.
And where I come down, I mean, even if we want to say, okay, the experts disagree, there's different information, or some people draw different conclusions from the same study or data or evidence or whatever, the reality is that there are studies that are pointing in different directions in terms of their conclusions. Now, we have a separate question of, well, how much can you trust a study's conclusion? Because there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that there's a lot of skewing of studies, if not outright, and additionally outright fraud in the medical publishing industry, that is driven by money and not by objective science. But just looking at face value, there are studies out there that come up with contradictory or conflicting opinions with one another. And just that fact alone, to me, is enough to establish that we as individuals should have the right to decide what we get injected into our bodies as just sort of a policy and legal matter. And the practical reality is that we have a limited right to make that decision where vaccines are concerned, and an increasingly limited with states passing laws. For example, five states at least have passed laws in the last year or two alone restricting access to vaccine exemptions for school children, for example. And in at least three instances, I believe, unconstitutionally so. So here we have, at best, conflicting medical evidence, which weighs heavily in favor in just a pure common sense level of people being allowed to make a decision. You know, which experts do you trust, or which, you know, level of risk? You know, if the government should not be allowed or able and should not take upon itself to decide which experts or which studies it's going to adopt as its position and then impose that on the masses. When there is legitimately conflicting information, the government needs to stand back and say, you know, that's not up to us to decide. That's not the role of government. That's not the function of government, unless, of course, you're a pharmaceutical company who wants to control government to maximize your profits. And that, of course, is, I would assert, adamantly is the state of affairs we have today that has occurred over time, that industry, not just pharmaceutical industry, but industry across the board seeks to control and influence government, and many industries have refined that technique or that goal or ability, have honed it rather well to the point to where the pharmaceutical industry very directly controls healthcare policy and law at the state and federal level throughout the country. This includes the mandating of vaccines, products that they know are causing unnecessary death and disability. But look what the way they have this whole thing wired. They get federal subsidies to research and develop vaccines. They got state and federal government mandating their products and mandating more and more of their products as time goes on. They have federal government paying for any damage or harm caused by their products. If you are among the elite in the world who are very skilled at throwing ethics, morality out the window and just looking at it as a pure numbers operation financially, it's the ideal business arrangement. And so if their goal is to maximize their profits, of course they would be seeking to control policy and to control laws. And they have done that at a disturbingly deep and thoroughly corrupt level. So we've got a very serious state of affairs in the country today, and to one degree or another, I think probably around the world. And we've got a very complicated situation that needs to be unwoven and taken apart and reassembled in a more ethical and appropriate manner.
Don't we want a government that is very minimal in the business of the people and that it will run efficiently without having to do that as best it can and yet still maintain safety and protection of the people?
Well, I think you're going to find, we've always had, and I think probably always will, have people who will disagree on exactly what government's role should be, how far should it go, what should it get into, what should it not get into, as far as the details and specifics. And there certainly are some good arguments for different answers to that question as it pertains to different things. But clearly, I think whatever your position however conservative or not, you know, whatever you think generally should be the role of government, one of its roles should not be to make a decision for the masses about who's right when experts disagree, especially when you're talking life and death matters. The reason that I think that this has gone so far with vaccines and maybe not as far in other areas is this myth that keeps continually being perpetuated that your vaccine protects other people. The idea that, well, maybe you get to decide what goes into your body in terms of whether you want to smoke or drink or whatever. Everybody knows that smoking and drinking are not good for you, but a lot of people do it anyway. Well, they should have a right to make that decision. You know, we should have the right to be self-destructive or risk being self-destructive if that's what we want to do. Maybe you're foolish if you do those things to a level where you're causing yourself harm, but would anybody disagree that you shouldn't have the right to do that? Most people would say, go ahead and smoke if you want to be crazy, an idiot, or whatever, if that's their opinion, but you should have the right to choose to do that. But we don't have the right to choose whether or not to put vaccines into our body, in theory, because you have a social obligation to be vaccinated because your vaccine protects other people. And we really have to dig at the heart of this myth and expose it as the myth that it is if we're going to make any headway into the idea that, no, even with vaccines, you should have a fundamental right to decide what goes into your body or into your children's bodies. It's this idea about herd immunity, that you have to get vaccinated to protect everybody else. And There's just so many things wrong with that theory. I don't know if we want to take the rest of the show talking about it. But
let's save that for another time. And so that's kind of the risk ratio and also the false premise about whether the herd immunity theory actually is real. So let's go ahead and talk about the reassessment of flu shots as we are now beginning the flu season, or we've already been in it for a couple of months, but now the winter weather changes and the days are shorter, and therefore we're more likely to succumb to these infectious diseases because we don't have enough vitamin C and vitamin D going in our system.
Well, that certainly is one of the very plausible theories about it, that supposedly we see more, there's certain kinds of diseases associated with low levels of vitamin D that are sometimes more prevalent in higher latitudes, further away from the equator, and some people are theorizing that's because of the relative lower exposure to direct sunlight, that people in higher latitude areas tend to have less exposure to the sun than people in lower latitudes with warmer climates where people are outside more often. There was an article just very recently in the New York Times, of all places, among other things, it says last month, in a step tantamount to heresy in the public health world, and I have to agree with them on this line here, scientists at the Centers for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, they released a report saying that influenza vaccines provide only modest protection for healthy young and middle-aged adults, and little, if any, protection for those 65 and older who are most likely to succumb to the illness or its complications. And usually it's not the flu directly that kills anybody, but really it's the vast majority of time if somebody dies, it's not really from the flu, it's from the complications resulting from the flu. But they just say it's based on inadequate evidence and poorly executed studies. And this is a real interesting thing to hear. I've talked about in the past about the Cochrane Collaboration, an independent consortium of international consortium of medical researchers. They've done reviews of the flu vaccine literature in the past and found that the flu vaccines really have little benefit, but they see widespread manipulation of conclusions in the medical literature. So, again, serious problems in the medical literature publishing arena. Interesting to hear this coming from the University of Minnesota, though, because that's somewhat more. I mean, the Cochrane Collaboration is widely respected, as I understand it, though certainly not happily received when they come out with something that is criticizing vaccines. But the University of Minnesota may be a bit more of a mainstream source to hear this kind of a criticism of flu vaccines. They basically are saying, Michael Osterholm, who's a director for the Center of Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, says, "We have over-promoted and over-hyped this vaccine. It does not protect as promoted. It's all a sales job. It's all public relations." Boy, what a wonderful thing to hear, refreshing in its honesty and clarity, but very curious. You know, my first thought is, well, there goes his career. And it's really sad, you know, that that's actually a legitimate consideration. But I'll give you an example. I hear, been working this fall like never before with healthcare workers all over the country who are looking for what are their rights to refuse flu vaccines that are being mandated more and more of all healthcare workers around the country, or they lose their job. And what I hear from these folks that come to me is that, and certainly my impression, and I hear this from people all over the country, my impression is that those people who come to me asking for my help represent a much, much larger group of people in numbers, healthcare workers, who don't want the vaccine but are afraid to even ask for an exemption because they're afraid they'll be singled out and fired. There is, I don't even call it the medical profession or the healthcare profession anymore. I call it the healthcare oppression because that's what I'm hearing from employees, hospital employees all over the country, that the work environment is oppressive. People are not even, people are even afraid to ask for an exemption. They're afraid they lose their job. So when you don't get on board with mainstream medical views, and you're an employee in the mainstream medical system, your career is potentially at risk. So it takes more than just clear information for somebody to speak out against vaccines, I guess is where I'm going with all of this. It takes courage, genuine, true courage, to make a statement that this person is making. And more people are speaking out from inside the mainstream community about problems with vaccines, and that's a good thing. But I think it represents potentially a much larger number of people who have concerns who just don't feel like they can speak out at all because their careers and jobs are at risk if they do so. So my hat's off to Dr. Osterholm in recognition that he's doing something that could be risky to his career.
I tell you, I have a slightly different take. I think that you're correct. Number one, he's the point person for this change in attitude. What I think might be happening is that the authorities and the companies producing the vaccines are getting the message that people are questioning getting the vaccines, that people are afraid of the side effects. They're protecting their children and their own health. I think that they're getting the message that people are skeptical and have great concerns and grave concerns about what Michael Osterholm says, that this is being over-promoted, and it's in your face. no matter where you go, you're going to see or even get a phone call from people, did you get your flu vaccine? And in that way, I think, you know, there's almost a tipping point to that, that people are going to turn around and go the other way, and they're seeing people wanting to opt out. Because of this, they have to change their tune. They have to get on board. They have to now say, you know what, maybe for the flu vaccine, put parentheses around or quotes around flu vaccine, yeah, maybe this one vaccine has been overhyped, but don't neglect your other vaccines because they are very important. And so do you hear my gist of this? It's almost like a political election where now all I hear on the radio or wherever is, how are we going to rebrand the Republican Party? And to me, those are precisely what they say. How will we rebrand? And it's that rebrand to me says remarket. How will we put a new face, a new facade, a new, you know, public view on something that we're just doing behind closed doors? That's really, you know, not actually taking action and changing what we do in the manufacturing process, but what is it that we're going to say in public to other people? That's kind of what I'm getting at. What do you think about those ideas?
Well, I think as the alternative vaccine community, that we need to think more strategically in terms of what is our goal and what is the best way to accomplish it. And these, you know, those are short questions, but just enormously complex discussions and ongoing discussions. But for example, if we're going to chip away at what I think is largely the psychological issue, you know, as I've said before, I don't think there's any shortage of information at this point. What there's a shortage of is people who are able and willing, and I think it's emotionally, to look at the issue, to look at it objectively, to come to conclusions, because it's a psychological defense mechanism and probably unconscious in most of us, or subconscious, that kicks in, because if the anti-vaccine people are right, then we live in very dark and disturbing times in terms of what's actually happening and who's doing it and at what level and so forth. And so that's just something that is difficult for most people to wrap their minds around in terms of their own psychological worldview. We'd have to shatter most people's current psychological worldview if we are going to have them see what's going on. So achieving that goal many times may be best done chipping away a little at a time. So let's pick one vaccine. Let's look at the flu vaccine. Let's look at a problem with that. It's much easier for somebody to write an article about a specific vaccine or a specific issue with a specific vaccine and have people hear what they're saying than it is to sort of just take one broad sweep and say, look how bad vaccines are. Did you know that 90 to 99% or 90 to 95% of infectious disease reduction occurred before vaccines in the 1900s and all the other kinds of things we can pull up to say, here are the problems with vaccines collectively. That's a bigger bite, perhaps, than many people emotionally can take on, but maybe they can hear one little piece. Now, I'm not suggesting that Dr. Osterholm is anti-vaccine and he's thinking strategically here.
He's not anti-vaccine. It says precisely in the article, he considers himself a pro-vaccine guy, quote unquote. And
yeah,
but that doesn't
tell us anything about whether he's anti-vaccine. That just tells us that he knows how to protect his career when he's going to go out on a limb with vaccines. It may be absolutely true, but it may not be. I mean, you know, it's like that commercial on TV. I don't know if you've seen where a girl and a guy are talking, and the guy says, "How did you know that?" And she says, "I got it on the internet, you know." Well, how do you know it's true? And because everything on the internet is true, it has to be. How do you know that? The internet. And it's just a joke on TV, and it's a very funny one. But the point is anybody can say anything they want to on the internet or anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And this is a situation where even if you're pro-vaccine and you're making a comment that could be interpreted as anti-vaccine, you, of course, are going to qualify that by saying, "I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm just talking about this one little thing. But if you are anti-vaccine completely and you were making a comment strategically, you would say the same thing, you know, if you had any sense, because that's what you'd have to do to protect your career. So I'm not accusing Dr.
It's too complicated for me, Alan. It's like double spy, triple spy. I don't know what it is. And I mean, he does actually say use the vaccine. The safety profile is actually quite good. We've just oversold it. So he's just dealing with the marketing value of this vaccine. But it's not going to work nearly as well as everyone says. Use it, but it's not going to work. Now, that is really bizarrely weird that he would say that. Okay.
Yeah, so you have to ask, is he confused in his message? Is the article just not quoting him accurately or presenting it well? Is he trying to raise an issue and protect his career at the same time? Who knows? I mean, but your point is a valid one, that there seems to be some mixed messages in this article. That in and of itself speaks of problems, or implies anyway, problems within the healthcare arena, along the lines of what I was just saying before. There is not freedom of choice in the healthcare, freedom of speech, not freedom of choice either, but there's not freedom of speech in the healthcare profession. Clearly, you're not allowed to voice an opinion that is contrary to the status quo or the policy of your hospital, if you're a hospital employee. Anybody who speaks out with an opposing view is immediately reprimanded or chastised or worse. And
I see.
So it's and the one place I want freedom of speech everywhere, but the one place that is particularly critical for me is in the healthcare field. I want people concerned with my health to be completely free to consider all the possibilities and options and openly have access to all the different views, whether they're contradictory or opposing or not. And, you know, I want everything on the table because I want the best answer for me to be the one that floats to the top, and that can't happen unless they're both, you know, out there.
Well, when you talk, when you talk about freedom of information, I'm sorry to say that the Prop 37 in California, the GMO labeling proposal, that bill was not passed by a small margin. And I understand, unfortunately, that there was a lot of collusion or corruption or stuff going on, that people were intentionally being misinformed with mailings and other kinds of mass media due to the amount of money that was put into that campaign against having that Proposition 37 passed. Nevertheless, I hope that can you tell me legally, is there another opportunity for that to come before the public again?
I don't know the details about how that works, but I would imagine whatever the process or procedure is for getting it up could be repeated. This is the beauty of the legislative approach to dealing with these issues as opposed to litigation, just speaking in broad sweeping terms here. You know, you can keep trying to pass something over and over again until you get it passed. You take something to court and you lose, potentially you get legal precedent set in the opposite direction that you were hoping to get it set if you had won your case. And so the litigation approach, you have to look at each case on a case-by-case basis, but just as a general proposition, it's a risky place to go, because if you lose, you lose. Whereas in the legislative arena, if you don't succeed in getting something passed, you can try to pass it again. It's just so disturbing on such a fundamental level. I can't even see why there would be a fight about the idea of you get to decide, you know, to know what goes into your body in terms of food, and therefore everything should be labeled. To me, that's just sort of so simplistic that I can't even understand why there's an argument about it, let alone how it could lose.
It makes logic. It makes common sense. It sounds very logical, but people have a lot of questions and doubts that perhaps if the legislation was passed, who is going to fund it? Who's going to bear the brunt of cost of relabeling? That answer is basically manufacturers have to relabel their products constantly to keep them up to date, and so that's where that is. And who is going to oversee and supervise the labeling? I think I have a question about that. And so people were very hesitant
I just, you know, the idea, I mean, am I as a consumer willing to pay to have the information about what is in the foods that I buy? I already do that. You know, I pay for the packaging. I pay for the growth and production of the crops or the manufacture of the ingredients or whatever it is. You know, we already pay for all of that. We're already paying for the labeling that's on there now. And the idea that changing the labeling, sure, there's going to be a temporary cost in changing whatever the current labeling is, but they already have to label things. That's a part of the manufacturing procedure already. So I just don't see how that's a significant financial concern to me as a consumer. If I end up having to pay, you know, 2% more for food to know what's in it, it's worth it to me to do that. And it shouldn't really even be anywhere near that much over the long term. But I don't know. You know, are we as a society really saying it's more important to save a little money than it is to know what we're eating, which can cost us a lot more than whatever we're saving in the long term anyway? And I think part of it is just the lack of awareness of how critical the issue really is. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there was misinformation or disinformation used to create opposition to it. I have to question, and I don't have any specific information on this one way or the other, but if there has been false information used to sway the outcome of an election or of a decision, you know, that certainly raises hypothetically, if not literally, some legal questions, legal issues. But
I think that they were very savvy in the way that they did it so that they could get around it. I understand that there was a flyer or some sort of a piece of literature that said Democratic on it, but because it didn't say Democratic Party, they were okay. You know, it said Democrat.
Wow.
It said Democratic vote no, and so it that kind of thing can mislead people to think that if I'm voting Democratic, I better vote no, and that's how they would get those folks to do that.
Yeah, well, that would be fraud or deception, and whether or not that's, you know, grounds for a lawsuit and a revote or something like that is all, you know, procedural details that would be specific to California, and I wouldn't have any idea off the top of my head whether or not or how that works. But conceptually, it's very disturbing to hear you talk about something that would potentially have been very deliberately done to deceive. Of course, that goes on all the time in our systems, and part of the problem with the current system is that maybe not even so much sometimes the systems themselves is that people with a lack of integrity can manipulate the system in inappropriate ways to achieve ends that serve their personal or private agendas, but not the agendas of society as governments are supposed to do.
Okay, do you have any other major issues up this month that you want to talk about?
Sure do. There was a recent article here I've got talking about a CDC panel has expanded the Tdap vaccine as recommendations for pregnant women, Tdap being the tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis. There's DTaP and Tdap vaccines, just different versions of the same thing. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, they voted recently to expand the recommendation for the tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis, or Tdap vaccine, during pregnancy to encompass all pregnant women, regardless of vaccination history, including repeat vaccinations in subsequent pregnancies. Before this recent vote, the ACIP recommendations for the Tdap in pregnancy targeted previously unvaccinated pregnant women. I've got to stop for a second here. I did a presentation in St. Louis earlier this year. I believe it was in July. to a wonderful group of folks, Childbirth and Postpartum Professional Association, women in that line of work from all over the country and in some cases around the world. And in preparing for that presentation, and they were particularly concerned about issues related to their profession, which would, of course, include vaccines for pregnant women and newborn children. And I went and looked at a list of the package inserts for many different vaccines. I just sort of took a random sampling, whether it was a vaccine for children or for adults or whatever. And I could not find one that said that there were any studies that had been done on pregnant women. It would be unethical to conduct studies about vaccines on pregnant women. Let's, you know, just see how many unborn fetuses get harmed by a vaccine for pregnant women. Obviously, on a common sense level, that would be an unethical study to conduct in the first place. And to the best of my knowledge, no such studies have ever been conducted. And that's why the CDC's position historically on pregnant women is you do not vaccinate pregnant women unless you've got some really compelling issue or serious issue. And I think the first example we saw of that was any sort of widespread recommendation, at least that I was ever aware of, was the swine flu vaccine. For some reason, they were really pushing that on pregnant women because they were claiming that it was the swine flu was, for some reason, particularly dangerous for pregnant women. Turned out to be completely absurd and foolish because the number of pregnancy terminations associated with the swine flu vaccine in 2009 and 2010 was something on the order of 25 times the previous years was associated with the seasonal flu vaccine. And you have to wonder, when you see things like this, why would you recommend vaccines on pregnant women? Why would you push that when there's no studies to tell you whether it's safe or not? And I have healthcare professionals from all over the country, and I haven't had lots of these, but I've had a few, where they're pregnant, and the employer is saying, we don't care, get the flu shot anyway, it's safe. And they're saying it's safe because the CDC is saying it's safe, but there's no studies to back that up. And you just got to wonder, what in the world is going on here? Many of these vaccines have polysorbate 80 in them, an ingredient that has been shown to cause infertility with laboratory animals. That doesn't necessarily mean it'll do that with humans, but it certainly raises a valid question of will it or not. And but again, conducting the studies is something that's unethical to do. If you don't have a, and I don't think there's a compelling reason to vaccinate anybody with any vaccine ever, but even from the mainstream point of view, if there's a compelling reason to vaccinate somebody who's pregnant, then maybe you do it, but not just as a general broad recommendation. So when the CDC's ACIP, Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, comes out with a broad recommendation saying we need to vaccinate pregnant women with a Tdap vaccine, and every time they get pregnant, we need to vaccinate them again. And the rationale was to improve the uptake of the Tdap in pregnancy, which is currently only 2.6%, and reduce the morbidity and mortality associated with pertussis in infants younger than 2 months. In other words, supposedly by vaccinating the pregnant women, you're protecting the newborn child. Where's the research for that? There isn't any research for that.
You bring up the question that's probably in the mind of every person who is hearing this news, because we want to know, what was it in the people's in the CDC's recommendation that brought this issue to the foreground, that they would tell this particular group of people that they needed to get the vaccine no matter what? What instigated such a decision?
Well, the ACIP pertussis vaccine work group concluded a review. They say they did a review of published and unpublished studies on the use of Tdap in pregnant women. So I'm not seeing seeing reference to this in the package inserts on the vaccines. But they're claiming there's some research here that they're basing this on. And they concluded that a single dose of Tdap at one pregnancy was insufficient to provide protection for subsequent pregnancies, and that the benefits of vaccination outweigh the theoretical risks of severe adverse events.
They dropped the significance, don't they, by putting the word theoretical before the word risk.
Yeah, the benefits aren't theoretical, but the risks are.
Isn't that strange?
Yes, isn't that convenient?
Well, it indicates a bias, doesn't it, when we read those words? And they're so innocuous that people don't recognize that they are being told something that is one person's point of view or one group of point of view.
Well, and
it's a deliberate
Hello? Tactic. Hello? Hello?
Hi, I lost your sound.
All right, I'll call back in.
No, you're there. I hear
you
now. I don't know where you went a minute ago.
Okay, I'm glad I'm back. I didn't go anywhere on purpose,
okay.
I swear.
Oops. Okay, I don't know what happened, but all right.
Yeah, well, it's a deliberate tactic. It's an emotional manipulation. You throw in words like that, and it creates maybe not even consciously an emotional bias. It's subtle but deliberate. I mean, the ASAP, they had a vote of 14-0 with one abstention that they approve the proposed recommendations that providers of prenatal care implement a Tdap vaccination program for all pregnant women, and that healthcare personnel administer a dose of Tdap during each pregnancy, regardless of the patient's Tdap history. I don't know. I just find this so disturbing, because to me, it just, all of this collectively, you know, flu vaccines for pregnant women, Tdap vaccines for pregnant women, swine flu vaccines, especially for pregnant women, and the results we have, that Gardasil for all women of childbearing age. I used to completely ignore, or if I did anything, laugh at the so-called conspiracy theories associated with fertility or population control or so forth. And I actually agree that population with people who feel that population is a serious issue. It's growing exponentially. We have a finite planet, and there are, you know, many different opinions about how many people the planet can sustain, and I don't want to engage in that argument, but I think ultimately it's a finite planet with finite resources, and even with the best of management of those resources, at some point there's a ceiling to the number of people the planet can adequately sustain. So I think population is a very serious issue, and the amount of time that passes for the population to double has gotten shorter and shorter and shorter over, you know, recent decades. So, serious issue. But I draw the line at somebody else deciding how they're going to take care of that and imposing infertility on people without their permission or knowledge and consent. Or worse, if there truly are any outright population reduction agendas. And I tell you, I used to laugh at all this stuff. But in 2009, who was it? One of the Baxter sent contaminated vaccines all over Europe. And by chance, some researchers in the Czech Republic tested a batch of the vaccines on ferrets, and all the ferrets died. And when they looked into it, they found live avian bird flu virus mixed with seasonal flu virus. And you've got a lethal virus that's not highly transmissible among people mixed with a seasonal flu virus that is not particularly lethal but highly transmissible among people. And you have a prescription there for a potentially potent bioweapon. And the medical people I talked to said it's not possible for that to have been an accident. It's not something that one person with a key could slip in at night and dump a little vial of bird flu virus into the vat and go, you know, tee-hee-hee-hee, now everybody's going to get bird flu. There had to be a group of people who knew that was going on. They used these bio-level safety 3 protocols, very, very strict protocols. Why would you do that? You know, either you want to kill people or you want to make them sick so you can sell them solution, and you don't care that some of them are going to die, because that's what would happen if this had been actually administered all over Europe. So, you know, some of these so-called wild conspiracy theories aren't so wild and conspiratorial in the sense of just speculation or interpretation. Some of this is from some fairly concrete, tangible information. And yet, for some reason, this information seems not to be getting outside of limited alternative circles. What can we do, folks, to get this information more broadly recognized, to bring it under a brighter light for more people to see?
That's a good question.
It's an ongoing question that we need to carry with us and continue to explore on this show and among one another privately and any place we can, because that's, you know, the answer to that question, finding and implementing the answer to that question or not, is the difference in whether this we keep going down the path we're going or not. The Healthy People 2020 agenda, this is a project that's state and federal government and private pharmaceutical industry company agenda, includes a specific agenda not only to vaccinate all healthcare workers with the flu vaccine, but to vaccinate all employees in the country with the flu vaccine. That's an explicit stated objective. There is no light at the end of this tunnel, folks, and there's nobody who's outside of the sites. The healthcare workers are on the front lines, but they want to revaccinate all adults. And in 2010, the number of vaccines on the market or in development was over 330. There is always going to be another vaccine to give you, and always another person to get a vaccine. There is no light at the end of this tunnel. We have to become legislatively active now, because the laws are changing in the wrong direction before our eyes. And if we don't start opposing these laws and demanding that our legislatures enact laws moving the other direction to allow more freedom of choice, it's just going to get tighter and tighter and tighter, more and more people having to get more and more vaccines and fewer ways to say no.
Well, we're at the end of our hour, and I'm going to continue another hour after you doing a reading on the chapter from Dr. Herbert Roberts on homeopathy and actually ways that we can become better physicians and what are the principles by which we do that. So why don't you, obviously I know that, Alan, you are a fantastic leader in the vaccine rights arena, providing information and advice to people in all avenues of society, whether they're an immigrant to the country, whether they're a parent wondering about what to do about getting their kids into school, in the healthcare area of hospitals, nurses, providers, and the military. So there's lots of people out there who are now questioning vaccines and what they can do to procure their rights and freedoms. They can reach you at, and it is Vaccine Rights, is that correct?
Yep, vaccinerights.com.
VaccineRights.com. They can go to PandemicResponseProject.com. They can go to NVIC Advocacy Portal and get active in your own state and neighborhood. Connect with other people who are like-minded in your area. And there is also your guide, your ebook, which probably a lot of people have now been downloading, because it has a basic foundation of information to know whether they need you to give you a call for professional help or whether they can handle their situation on their own.
Yes, the Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, available at vaccinerights.com. And Debbie, thank you for your kind support and compliments to the work I do. It wouldn't be possible without working with incredible people like yourself. So thank you so much for your support.
We admire you, and you're one of those courageous people who are out there being leaders, speaking up in the face of opposition and challenge. But now people are getting the message. They are calling you. Your phone is ringing off the hook. And we have up to 1,000, over 1,000 listeners to each of our shows with you. So you're doing a great job of informing the public and creating that light. We're going to end the show with your exit song, a singing about the light, and then we're going to come back on again and talk about homeopathy for those who wish to learn and listen.
Thank you so much, Debbie. Take care.
Okay. Take care until next week. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
If you would like to help support the show as a sustaining member or have suggestions for future shows, we invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Please share by tweeting on Twitter, posting on Facebook and MySpace, and all other social networks. You may select the widget and place the player on your blog or website. With gratitude to all our listeners, let's go!
Hi, we're back. We took a real quick break, and we're going to continue with a study of the Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, written by Dr. Herbert A. Roberts, M.D. Yesterday, after Dr. Otto's show about cardiology and health, heart health, and we had a variety of questions yesterday from listeners, which he answered and is going to prepare for next week, talking about the breast health because it's part of the chest, and we had a caller ask about that and cancer and fungus and how we care for ourselves. And we're going to continue now with Chapter 5. First, just to get you up to speed on Chapter 4, which was called The Vital Force, as expressed in functions, in health, in disease, in recovery, and in cure, he ends the chapter with these questions, which we may want to inquire and ask ourselves, what are the answers to? To what do we attribute the growth and the development of the individual? And would people say that is in the material realm, or is that in the spiritual realm? Is that pre-programmed in our DNA, or where do you think there is a beginning to life? What do we attribute the growth and development of the individual? Does that include the environment, that's nature versus nurture? Is it the dynamics in the family, the relationships that we have? Is it the foods that we eat and how we maintain our environment? Do we come into this world pure and then get some kind of contamination? Well, we do talk about coming through the birth canal and then being infected by all of these bacteria. And so there is a process to birth, to life, and growth and development. The next question he poses is, what is the direction of growth? And he does kind of answer that, saying, if you listen to yesterday's show, that it is a spiraling upward. This is a spiraling movement, not just circular, but more like the Fibonacci circle. It's from the inward out. Okay, that is his answer, and you need to read or listen to the previous chapter. Basic question, what is health? Another, what is disease? What do we consider health? Is it the mind, body, and spirit? Do we look at all the parts of the body? Is that the triad or the trinity? And what do we consider disease? Is it something that holds us back from growing into that upward spiraling pattern that reaches toward the spiritual? What do we mean by miasms or dyskrasias? And what is their effect on the development of the individual? And here, those are vocabulary words used in homeopathy, dealing with heredity, dealing with that nature aspect. What is it that we come into the world with? What weaknesses do we have? How are we going to express our stresses and strains in life? Some people are going to break down in one way, while another person is going to express it in a completely different way. How do we regard acute diseases in homeopathy? Do they have a purpose? Do they have a function? Do we need to see them very clearly in order to prescribe a good similimum homeopathic remedy? What conditions do we speak of as self-curative? Can we cure ourselves? Is there a condition in which we can do that? And then, how do we regard such conditions as semi-chronic or chronic skin manifestations, discharges, etc.? Thus, we started out with that acute disease, which might have a positive influence. And if you don't have the strength within your own vital force to overcome that acute disease, you might die from it. But if you're living, what are self-curative? Could you be strengthened by an acute disease? And then the outcome is you're stronger for other onslaughts to your system. And how do we regard those semi-chronic or chronic diseases that he's talking about? Something that after this acute illness, you didn't really come back into your full potential, into your normal. People might call it that new normal is the term that's sometimes being used. And when we have that new normal, homeopathically, Dr. Roberts is calling it a semi-chronic or chronic condition that you're just managing or coping with or dealing with, or yeah, you're accepting it. And the question is, can we do something about it? Dr. Roberts says, what is the order of cure? And this is something that all homeopaths learn about Herring's Law. The order of cure manifests itself in a number of ways, and that tells us whether we are progressing toward good health again. He says that includes symptoms disappear from above downward. The complaints go from an important vital organ to a less important organ. and symptoms disappear in the reverse order of their appearance. And often in Chinese medicine, Asian medicine, you're going to hear that same direction of cure to know that things are getting better. He lastly asks, in taking a case, why do we consider the sequence of symptoms in their onset to be an important point? So here, when we're doing approving of a remedy or we're learning about a remedy, we note what happens in a journal. How does the disease or symptoms first begin, and how do they progress, and how do they end? And the same thing occurs with a natural disease. There is a sequence, prodromal, and these are the phases of disease. And when you learn that, you're going to recognize the direction of cure, because it's going to go in the reverse order. And that's probably the answer to that question. Now we're ready to move on to Chapter 5, Vital Energy in its Universal Application. The vital energy is that force which animates each individual. While the vital energy is in the individual is said to have life, to be, to exist. It sounds very spiritual, doesn't it? That the body is totally dead and inanimate until the Creator will breathe life into it. So he says, even as the individual is derived from, becomes from, the mating of two individuals, from the cell mating of which this vital force may be handed on with physical characteristics of the parents, so is the vital force itself derived from an infinite source, a storehouse of dynamic power, capable of developing and reproducing to an infinite degree in its manifestations. Yet each individual partaking in greater or less degree of general vital characteristics common to all. And that is quite wordy. A very long one sentence is five lines. One sentence is one paragraph. And he says, the vital energy animates the person. And that means that we're alive, we're existing. You know, that animating force is always there with in the spiritual realm. It's just animating into the body. He keeps going back to the mating of two individuals from the cell. And that was in previous chapters about the egg and the sperm coming together to create this new being that is now enlivened. And there is a storehouse of dynamic power, which he says is derived from an infinite source. So in a way, humans are infinite because they come from the infinite. At least they have infinite potential and infinite power. He says, capable of developing and reproducing to an infinite degree in its manifestations. Quite powerful to hear this word infinite being bandied about so much. Yet each individual partaking in greater or less degree of general vital characteristics common to all. So all of us have common characteristics. Some of us may exhibit some of them more or less differently. And that's what makes us an individual. Dr. Roberts says, the vital force in the individual becomes, therefore, the ego, that most intimate spark of the individual, the ego meaning the I presume, your identity. This is your most intimate spark of individuality, which is itself the essence of the individual, and which divides his individuality from all others, yet is his closest relationship to the universe. So isn't this interesting, really spiritual in his development, chapter 5, that we all come from the infinite source of creation when the cell is fertilized, and yet each of us has an I, an ego, an individual spark. That is, all of us come from the from the infinite, and yet, and we have infinite power within, and yet we are all individuals. This is sounds contradictory, because obviously you can't possibly split up this infinite, and yet this is what is true in the universe. This closely relates him to all living creatures. So we are all connected. We are all one. We are all coming from the same source. Yet he is identical with none. Isn't that something? It is at once his tie to all energy, all vitality, all life, and at the same time, his insulation against the massed power of the whole. So in a way, why he says insulation against the mass power, maybe this power is, this infinite power is so incredibly awesome. How can we deal with it? How can we even think about it or imagine it or handle it? If our body, which is limited in its ability to exist, without that animating force, we would not exist. And now, how do we put an infinite source into something that is time and material limited? Very existential article here. Probably religion was the first expression of thought to formulate this vital concept of life, he says. Many religions through many ages have expressed the thought we find in the Bible, quote, and the Lord God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul, unquote. Quote again, before Abraham was I am, unquote. Religion accepts the concepts of infinite life on the spiritual plane, but has not attempted to apply it to all planes of existence. Science accepts it in part. One is tempted to say in fragments, but science has never correlated the whole, even on the material or intellectual planes. Astronomy is a part of science. Mathematics is an essential component of astronomy. Astronomy and mathematics, viewed in the light of whole vision of vital energy, are essentially a partial proof of the omnipresence of vital energy as being the moving energy, the activating power of the universe. So he's bringing here science and math and astronomy and mathematics, viewed in the light of the whole vision of vital energy, are essentially a partial proof of the omnipresence of vital energy. So he says it's not a complete proof. As logic deals with the principles governing the comparative and constructive faculties in the pursuit and use of truth, let us apply this science to our theorem and reason this through to its natural conclusions. Without this vital force, there can be no life, no development. Since there is no static condition in nature, without a healthy, normal development of the vital force, we find a state of decay and death. So here he's kind of saying, remember that inward-outward movement that he discussed in the previous chapter, that nature, there's no static condition. Everything is dynamic. Everything is moving. Even you are moving when you're staying still. All of the atoms, the electrons, are spinning. It's all inside of us, and the majority of us is actually empty space if we get into the physics of it. So the question is, without this vital force, there can be no life and no development. The development was something he addressed last, or the previous chapter. Since there is no static condition in nature, without a healthy, normal development of the vital force. So that vital force, which we could call almost our spiritual self, something within us that enlivens us, we need to, how can that develop? How can our vital force develop? So that is a question that he doesn't answer yet. We find a state of decay and death. So unless we're moving in a positive direction, outwardly spiraling up spiritually, then we're in the state of decline. As homeopathic philosophers, we do not concern ourselves at this time with the sociological aspects of this problem, although inferences from the foregoing statements may seem obvious. It is our duty to consider these primarily as they relate to the physical, mental, and spiritual well-being of our patients. And remember, this book is addressing and targeting homeopaths and other healthcare professionals who want to become good physicians, how to practice medicine using homeopathy. And he right now tables the sociological aspects of the development and good health of the person, while he wants to say, take a closer look at the physical, mental, spiritual well-being of each patient. And I wonder how many regular doctors ask you those types of questions. We have observed, Dr. Herbert Robert says, we have observed in the study of the human race that life is perpetuated under certain favorable conditions of mating. It is true that physical characteristics are handed on from parents to offspring, but that the parents actually give life to the child may reasonably doubt. So he's saying that it's not the parents that are giving life. We may say with all assurance that under favorable circumstances, life is handed on from the parents to the child in more or less perfect vigor. Whence life comes, we cannot say, but that it gives vigor in greater or less degree to the individual according to the heredity and the environment, we cannot doubt. So I think what he means is the zygote, the offspring, do come from the parents in terms of the physical body, but the vital force, the energetic body, is actually coming from that universal infinite source. And that's what he means by that. And that in the last sentence, whence life comes, we cannot say. So he really does not say about the life, when it's going to enter into the body, enter into the cells. But he says, but it gives vigor in greater or lesser degree to the individual according to the heredity and the environment. So nature, nurture once again. And so the creator, whoever it may be, the source of all, that says this life is going to come into the earth on this planet, in this body, in this family, in this time period, that is going to determine to a greater or lesser degree about the individual's health or possibility of vigor. Dr. Herbert Roberts says that life is continuous, we know to be true. There has been no age when all life has ceased. And we find this vital force, this energy, this dynamis, passed on in all forms and degrees of living creatures. History shows us that life has thus been manifest for so many centuries that we come by deductive reasoning to comprehend that life is infinite. It is eternally going on and on. So in a way saying, yes, we take it for granted, or we assume that tomorrow will be here, that the sun will rise, that people will still exist, that life will go on, except for those folks who say the end of the earth is near. And he says, this is life is continuous, we know to be true, based on our experience of life and history. When there is vital force, he says, there is action, motion. Action is one interpretation, one manifestation of vital force. So action in the world is what shows us that we're alive. We speak of the inanimate as dead, yet with death there is always decay. We think of the earth and other plants as dead, yet they are in continual motion according to their regular and defined direction through the universe, which has been observed and recorded by man. We may reason, therefore, that since these great bodies have regular motion and direction, they are impelled by some force, some energy, which, although it may not be what we have come to call vital energy, is in degree closely related to it. So existentially, again, philosophically, he says everything on the planet is, it's not really dead, it's alive, but it's moving in some energetic way, something like even half-life and of particles, that if it's here, there is force, there is life within it, but the question is how much life. It could be in the process of decay, so it's moving in a different direction than what we consider the action of life. Dr. Herbert Roberts says, if therefore this force, this energy actuates or permeates all forms and degrees of life, from the most humble and inconspicuous to the very planets, we may reasonably assume that vital force is the most fundamental of all conditions of the universe, and that the laws governing the vital force in the individual are correlated with the laws which govern all vital force, all forms of energy, wherever or however expressed. If we have no motion, no action, no direction without vital energy, it must be this energy which is responsible for all growth and all development in all spheres of existence. I'll repeat that one. If we have no motion, no action, no direction without vital energy, it must be this energy which is responsible for all growth and all development in all spheres of existence. So when we see volcanoes rising and mountains rising and ocean waves and whatever it is, we're seeing motion and action. We're seeing some vital energy within that. And that energy, that vital force, is responsible for plant growth, for everything that we observe in our world. Like all laws, the laws governing vital force may be infringed to some degree. The privilege granted to human life is the right of choice. Yay! So he's talking about freedom of choice. And this right of choice implies degrees of choice. The planets, being set in their courses, have no right of choice and move always according to law. Human beings, we know, to exercise the right of choice. And herein is our province as physicians. For in making the choice, which is often a choice against natural laws, we find the vigor of the vital force abated and a retrograde action of the body, mind, or spirit sets in. Thusly, he's kind of saying, if you do not follow natural laws, if we turn on our electricity and stay up all hours reading in the artificial light instead of taking rest to bring more life into the body during the hours when the sun is down and the moon is shining, then we're going against nature, against natural laws, and therefore we're going to see some development or some effect on the body. So what does he say? As we have pointed out before, vital force in its perfection means growth and development. Since there is no condition of standing still in nature, an infringement of natural laws means decay and death. the degree of the infringement, either in an individual or in his predecessors, determines the degree of decay and its speed. So we have parameters as to what is going to preclude the decay and the speed of the decay. Since human beings, as individuals, have the right of choice, even in the face of the operation of natural laws governing the vital energy, they have also been given those circumstances and conditions surrounding them which tend toward, one, a correct choice direction, and two, aids to correct the mistakes already made and to regain the normal balance. Both these conditions are found in three spheres: the physical, the mental, and the spiritual. So, meaning we're constantly getting cues in the three spheres, in our physical environment, by what we're thinking, in our mental environment, and in our spiritual environment, maybe you can say the heart or compassion or something that is ephemeral that you really cannot quantify or touch. But those bits of information from those three, the Trinity he calls, physical, mental, spiritual, are going to tell us how to stay in balance and how to move in the correct, take the correct choice. I guess that correct choice, you in the correct direction, you might even equate with a correct moral and ethical choice. What is the best thing to do for you, for the planet, for your family, friends, for other people, and also on the higher sphere of spiritual. On the spiritual place, he says, we find those aids which tend toward correct choice and aids to regain a lost balance in the form of religious convictions and beliefs. All those aids which foster the growth and development of the spiritual life of man. Okay, so that quantifies that. That number one where he says a correct choice and direction. Yes, we can make a choice, but if it doesn't have the essence of that spiritual choice, the choice may not be in the right direction. On the mental plane, we find instruction of various kinds which tends to development of the mental faculties. And all those things which go toward an honest and honest comprehension of the individual toward himself and his relationship to others and toward all life. In other words, those things which foster sanity. Aha! He connects the mind with sanity. On the physical plane, we find those things which tend to keep us healthy in the body, such as suitable foods and those things which we can adapt for better housing, cleanliness, sanitation, and many other things. We find on this plane, too, many substances closely allied to foods, which have within them a vital energy capable of being raised by potentization from the purely physical plane to that of the mental or even spiritual. This is most decidedly the study of homeopathic physician, for in these substances we find the most similar remedies for the conditions of the ills of man. So it raises homeopathic care to a very high level of care because it is addressing all three, the mental, physical, and spiritual levels, whereas allopathy typically does not. It just deals with some crude drugs working on the physical plane. And this might cause a problem with the balance of the other aspects, the emotional, the mental, and the spiritual plane. Dr. Robert says, these substances themselves are derived from three kingdoms, mineral, vegetable, animal. We cannot definitely say that the mineral substances in themselves possess vital energy, but they are fragments of that which composes the planet Earth, and that planet either possesses some form of vital energy in itself or is susceptible to being activated by vital energy to such an extent that it performs its appointed movements according to the law. And we can use these minerals by proper preparation in the form of vital energy, not to perpetuate life, but to influence it on all three planes of body, mind, and spirit, that the vital energy of the individual may be thereby guarded against decay and death. So here he's telling us that the use of potentized information remedies from mineral, vegetable, plant kingdoms provides some sort of information from the vital energy, that other realm that keeps us alive to be the I, to exist, that this prevents, moves us in the correct direction, spiraling upward rather than going toward, I would say, opposite, spiraling downward toward decay and death. And he goes on, we recognize the presence of vital energy in vegetable growth, for it is evidenced in growth and movement in the plant, according to the natural law of development, from within outward. And this he stated yesterday, from within outward is the direction of growth. The plant develops from the seed according to the physical characteristics of the parents, and again, under favorable circumstances, passes on this spark of vital energy in its own fertility. Not only do we know that vegetable growth has this manifestation of vital energy, but it has been observed that the mysterious vital force beyond our comprehension, which controls by law the planets in their courses and influences the winds and tides, influence the manner and periods of growth of the individual plant, thus again tying what we know to be a manifestation of life to the universal energy. So he's saying vegetable growth has vital energy and has been observed, this mysterious vital force. He says we don't really understand it. How could we ever understand it? It's beyond our comprehension, this vital energy that comes from the infinite, from the source, which controls by law, that is the infinite power of natural law, controls the planets, controls the winds, the tides, and influences the manner and periods of growth of individual plant. So the plant is programmed to, you know, you plant a seed and it's a dahlia is not going to grow a marigold. A pine tree is not going to grow a maple tree. So it is pre-programmed in the seed to grow from this mysterious vital force, tying what we know to be the life of the universal energy. The vegetable kingdom, he says, has probably served man in disease conditions longer than either the animal or the mineral kingdom. In the homeopathic method of preparing drugs for medication by releasing the energy therein through potentization, we have found that from this source again, which we regard as material, we can influence disorder on three planes of body, mind, and spirit. So with harboring within that vegetable, that plant, there is some vital energy that when we release it through the process of potentization, we can access it and use that source energy that is dynamic and everywhere to influence and correct some disorder that we might have in our bodies, mind, and spirit. And that is homeopathy. We comprehend, Dr. Roberts says, most easily the animation, the presence of vital energy in the animal kingdom. The medicine has long sought cure through the medium of substances derived from this source. That these substances have a tremendous power, we know to be true. Homeopathy, however, in distinction from ordinary medicine, believes that there too the release of power from the minimum of substance through potentization is that which will most quickly and accurately influence the disordered vital force of man on all three planes. Once again, he says that which is already animated, that we see animals walking about, that they also, we can get, derive some source of energy from them to move us in the right direction of all three planes, mind, body, and spirit. And that it has a very powerful force, probably because the animal energy is very close to our energy. And yet the plant energy also has a possibility of reviving us from shock. Going on, Dr. Roberts says, we believe that vital energy, as we comprehend it, is not a mass power, but an infinite number of egocentric sparks. We believe also that material substance, mass power in medication, would completely overwhelm the individual vital energy to complete annihilation, or would subvert it to eventual decay and death. And I think he's kind of hinting at drug power, the power of drugs or toxins or some mass power that could annihilate our inner vital energy, which is our existence that he spoke of earlier, that animates the body, that drugs can eliminate or annihilate and cause the decay and death, the wrong direction of growth, or the opposite direction of growth, may I say, rather than wrong, that it is not spiraling upward toward creation, but it is going into the material realm of decay. Dr. Roberts says, we believe that the mathematical law of quantity extends through all nature and applies to all vital energy in whatever form, and that if this is so, it is peculiarly applicable when we are dealing with that infinitely delicate balance of vital force in the individual. Let us look at this law of mathematics with that thought in mind. The quantity of action necessary to effect any change in nature is the least possible. And as Fink added, the decisive amount is always a minimum, an infinitesimal. And I keep going back to that tipping point. That is, what is the tipping point? What is the smallest amount, that straw on the camel's back, that's going to move into a new direction, into the healing action? If vital energy, Dr. Roberts says, is the fundamental power, the motivating factor of the universe, balance must be one expression of the law. If the very planets are kept in their place through the influence of vital energy, this must be an infinitely delicate balance. We see the effects of balance all through nature and natural expressions, and therefore we realize that balance power is one manifestation of the law. And gee whiz, all of a sudden I'm thinking manifestation of the law, and I think back on the show an hour and a half ago with Alan Phillips, that you see a picture of the scales to represent legality, a balance of equality, and keeping things in harmony and providing the best for people in a community, in an organization that works together. And the proper functioning of the legal system is a power and a balance of power. So not only is it within the medical field, within our bodies and our mind and spirit, but also out there in the controlling bodies of our legal system, which must be based upon a natural law. And that's what Greg talks about when he gets on our show. Since the earth upon which we live is so delicately poised that it holds its regular position and movements without deviation, says Roberts, according to law, anything upon the earth which lives or is subject to the influence of vital energy must therefore in some degree be susceptible to balance. We recognize more susceptibility to the manifestations and interplay of vital energy and the balance in the individuals of the human race than in any other form of existence, since we so often see the effects of the imbalance of the individual. So he's saying we see a lot of illness and disease and imbalance mentally, physically, spiritually in people. This is doubtless due to the influence of his power of choice. So he says he doesn't doubt that the reason that there's imbalance is because of a person's power of choice and whether they're choosing one direction or another, whether they're choosing growth over decay, which often influences his own dynamis and the dynamis of those with whom he comes in contact. So one person can affect another person. In other words, his very existence, since we so often see the effect of the imbalance of the individual. This is doubtless due to the influence of his power of choice, which I'm repeating, which often influences his own dynamis and the dynamis of those he comes in contact. And so that is a very strong statement. His very existence is an expression of vital energy. We all are constantly expressing this vital energy, this source energy, this animation, this dynamism. But he is also exposed to the influence of the vital energy of others. Woo! And the interplay of vital energy and balance from many sources may imperil his own balance. So you may become imbalanced due to the people who you are surrounding yourselves with. If there's negative imbalance in those who you're constantly in touch with, it's going to have an influence upon your energy. The resultant lack of balance in his own vital energy is disorder that manifests itself in a train of symptoms of disease. So what he says is, although we cannot touch or feel or see this vital energy, this universal infinite source energy, we're all affected by it, and based on our choices, we keep that ourselves in balance. And if people around us are making poor choices, we might be influenced by their dynamis, their energy, and it is all quite mathematical, he says. Let's see. And he says what we end up with is disease or dis-ease. And when we have this dis-ease or illness at a balanced state and see symptoms, whether on the physical, mental, or spiritual plane, that is indicating to us that something is out of balance. And most likely, that is the vital force, that animation to our body. Mathematics is the science which treats of the measuring of quantities and ascertainment of their properties and relations. This is an exact science. It is a part of the study of astronomy, among other natural studies, and it must be applicable in all spheres where any concept of measurement or relationship exists. Balance is the state of perfect relationship, the result of perfect computation, and the desired goal of all mathematics. So think about those scales, that perfect balance, and how delicate it is, and how the universe is delicately hung into a balance with the planets and the stars, the oceans and the wind and everything else. That reminds me of the butterfly effect. With one flap of the wings, something is changed. We might say that mathematics in its highest form is the perception of balance in its highest degree. Thus, we realize that the laws that apply to mathematics must be equally applicable to every condition where balance is a factor. Lack of balance in the individual may be engendered by the interplay of forces resulting from his privilege of choice. So it's a matter of choice, people, from the interplay of forces engendered by others. So that's another aspect. How are your relations with others, and over which he has little or no control of them, or by the released power of the infinitesimal amount of almost any substance. So we're also influenced by everything all around us in small quantities of animal, vegetable, or mineral, which has in itself the susceptibility of permeation or activation of vital energy. So all of those things all about us, plant, mineral, or animal, are impinging upon our vital energy. Here we see the applicability of the mathematical law. And he quotes the quantity of action, the actual quantity of substance susceptible to action, necessary to effect any change in nature, necessary to affect the balance of any living thing or the relationship between any living thing and circumstances, is the least possible. The least possible quantity can make an act change in action, whether it is a smile or a word or a hug or whatever it might be. The vital energy is going to receive that energy to get into balance or out of balance. The decisive amount is always a minimum, an infinitesimal amount. Wow. All the elements and all forms of matter are capable of being moved, activated by vital energy, although they may not. Oh, so I'm thinking, wow, just your thought itself. What you think can be the least amount, always minimal and infinitesimal, that can change the action, the vital energy in the body, whether or not it manifests. Disharmony, disease, imbalance comes from such an infinitesimal amount, not just thought, but beyond thought, that vital energy, that potentized homeopathic remedy. I'm going to repeat again the next paragraph that he says. He says, "And all the elements and all forms of matter are capable of being moved, activated by vital energy, although they may not themselves possess this energy within themselves." Wow, that's powerful thought there, that you might not hold that act, that vital energy inside of you, but it might be somewhere out there, somebody you know who has it, who can effectively create some kind of a balancing act. He says, all the elements and all forms of matter possess the possibility of divisibility to an almost infinite degree. And that's the power of 10. If you've ever seen that video or that concept or read that book, The Power of 10, which just goes infinitesimally outward into space and inward down into the minutia, into a microscope or electron microscope or even further. The greater the mass, quantity of elements or matter, the more inert they become. So the heavier it is, the more inert they become, because obviously it's very heavy and it's harder to move, and growth is all about direction and action. So here he says, thus, massed iron becomes useful to man as iron or steel rails, bridges, utensils and other material objects. Iron is a divided state. As a divided state enters into the human physical body as a component part of that which is activated by the vital energy, and as a part of the physical body, the vital energy plays through it. We all know that we have iron in our blood. Iron, even when massed and inert, has the power of attracting vital energy in the form of electricity. But so he's thinking of iron filings now and that current that's formed. Vital energy in the form of electricity, but iron in mass formation is not capable of balance and direction within itself to the degree that it is possible when its divisibility is greater. So he says that if there's a substance that is so heavy, so massive, it has less possibility of action and attracting the vital energy, whereas when it is broken down into smaller pieces, particles, such as what we have in our bloodstream of iron ferrum, or what you see iron filings, or the magnetic potential of iron, that it does have attracting vital energy in the form of electricity. It is a question, he says, whether matter itself, which we call at times inert, does not manifest active properties. In other words, is possessed of activity and motion. This has been demonstrated in Madame Curie's investigations of radioactive substances. Again, the far-reaching discoveries of Langquin in his demonstration of the activity within the atom of the physical cells. So perhaps he's saying even these massive substances, which we cannot imagine or see having active properties, actually do have motion within them. And then he calls up Madame Curie and radioactive substances, which are the lowest on the periodic scale and the heaviest. The greater the divisibility of elements or matter, he says, the more they exhibit the possibility of permeability by the vital energy, the energy being not dependent upon the mass, but on the play or balance between the positive and negative poles of the atom. So the more an element can be divisible in their matter, in their form, then it makes it exhibit the possibility of permeability by our vital energy, by the universal vital energy that these small particles, or whatever you want to call them, substances or energetic matter. Vital force, he says, is capable of three forms of action: motion, direction, and balance. So think about the planets: motion, direction, and balance. Think about you walking a tightrope or you on a bicycle: motion, direction, and balance. Or even just an older person just trying to walk. These manifestations of energy are an integral part of any exhibition of vital energy. Growth and development are directed motion, and in the degree of their perfection do we find the manifestations of balance. So we are perfect in a way, and based upon growth and development, we are directed motion. We are moving. And so he concludes with his questions at the end of each chapter. What do we mean by vital energy? What is the influence of energy on growth and development? What is the effect of potentization on material substances? Obviously, we release the vital energy so we can use it. How is the energy inherent in plants released for their use in remedies? Well, we do use the plants. We release them through potentization. State the mathematical law of least action. What is the mathematical law of least action? It's having to do with matter, don't you think, with mass. And he asks, how does the law of least action apply to the administration of homeopathic potentized remedies? Obviously, we've got to divide that matter, because they have the greater the divisibility of elements or matter, the more they exhibit the possibility of permeability by the vital energy. So we have to make it into the smallest possible amount, and that is what he said earlier. We want the smallest amount to cause action. And then we only have a minute left. The last question is, what influence has divisibility upon matter, and what three forms of action has vital force? The three forms of action have motion, direction, and balance. And so our next reading will be Chapter 6 of The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy by Herbert A. Roberts, M.D. If you've stuck with me this whole time, I want to thank you for listening to today's reading. On Monday, we will be back with Homeopathy on Health In Show, talking about how to use homeopathy for people who have trauma from floods and hurricanes. And it's very apropos in this time after Hurricane Sandy in the East Coast and other hurricanes around the world. So we're going to end the show, and I encourage you to visit Homeopathy World Community. Take a look at all those little links on the right-hand column, and we will see you. Have a great weekend, or whenever you're listening. The archives are all available. We might have between 400 and 500 archives of this show now. Take care, everyone. Sending love and light.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and special guests. We encourage you to follow our show, favorite the show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air, share with your friends on Facebook and Twitter, send in your comments and questions. See you the next time.